wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
So this week we're starting off by talking about a couple Nobel Prize winners. And you're our chemistry guy, and these are chemists who have recently passed away. What have they done? Why is this so important?
Yeah, well, it's been a sad couple of weeks, I guess, for the chemistry community. So two Nobel laureates in chemistry died a couple of weeks ago, sort of a couple of days apart from each other. So I think we should give them a little bit of publicity here on Dear Science. And probably the majority of you listening will never have heard of these guys. So the first is Richard Ernst, who is a Swiss chemist, and he worked at the ETH in Zurich for pretty much the majority of his life. He won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1991, and he won it, quote unquote, for his contributions to the development of high-resolution nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy, which, again, most of you listening probably haven't got a clue about.
No.
Okay.
No clue.
So, quick lesson on this. You may have heard of MRI.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. So you've heard of MRI. So MRI is a thing called magnetic resonance imaging, which allows you to look inside the body, essentially, using fancy magnets and stuff like that. NMR is a thing that came before MRI, and this is used by chemists to determine the structure of molecules. And that's the whole point of chemistry. We want to know, what do our molecules look like? What's their structure? What have we got in our sample? Blah, 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 blah. And NMR is an extraordinarily powerful technique that allows you pretty much to be able to do this to any organic molecule. And by organic, we mean molecules that are made up mostly of carbon and hydrogen. And those molecules basically make up life. So this is important in determining the structure of molecules of life. And Ernst made massive, massive contributions in the 1960s and 1970s to the development of this technique, which was only discovered sort of the mid-1940s. And basically, without going into enormous detail, what he did was to make it essentially easier. He made it quicker. He made it more powerful. And the techniques that he developed are used by every graduate chemistry student nowadays in the lab. And so his developments were quite remarkable, and he fully deserved the award of the Nobel Prize. So
quite a legacy.
Oh, hell yeah. No, absolutely extraordinary scientist, absolutely amazing. And the second of our Nobel laureate deaths is Eiichi Nagishi, and he worked at Purdue University in the States for the majority of his life. He actually worked under another Nobel laureate, Herbert C. Brown, so that's kind of a nice sort of transition there. Your boss is a Nobel laureate, and then you go on and win the Nobel Prize. Nagishi won the Nobel Prize in 2010, along with a couple of other folks for, and again, I quote from the Nobel Prize page, for palladium-catalyzed cross-couplings in organic synthesis.
No clue.
And again,
what that is.
Again, I know. So the guts of it is, okay, chemistry is about determining the structure of things. It's also about making things. So, you know, the two go together. You make things and then you determine their structure. And again, when you're talking about organic molecules, you're talking about molecules made up mostly of carbon, and you're looking to make these new molecules. They could be new drugs, they could be new this, new that, whatever. But one of the really important processes in chemistry is, how do you stick two carbon atoms together? How do you make a bond between two carbon atoms? It's not an easy thing to do. And if you can come up with a better way of making carbon-carbon bonds, then the world is going to beat a path to your door. And this is what Nagishi did, sort of starting off in the 70s. And he found a way of using the metal palladium to help catalyze these reactions that would form carbon-carbon bonds. And again, this pretty much changed organic chemistry. And again, what he developed is now used, again, by every graduate student who is doing sort of organic chemistry in terms of making carbon-carbon bonds. So it's turned into something that is just used, you know, pretty much every day these days, which is fantastic stuff. And I guess to show the importance of this thing about making carbon-carbon bonds, the Nobel Prize has been given now a total of 5 times for techniques that have been used to facilitate the making of carbon-carbon bonds. So, you know, both of these guys, absolute luminaries in their field, both thoroughly deserving of the award of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, and great scientists, and we will remember them.
Yeah.
You know, their legacy stands. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we got a typical BFM text just in saying that you can plug a guitar into an MRI and it's just a massive speaker, which I think is just so typical BFM. I love that text so much. Thank you for that. So next up, we're talking about a cancer drug that went out and is now being recalled.
Well, can I correct you?
Yes, you can.
Not a cancer drug, but it's just sort of a drug for sort of heartburn and peptic ulcers and stuff like that, esophageal, those sorts of things, okay? So that area of your body. It's a drug called ranitidine, which is otherwise known as Zantac, and it might be sort of better known under that latter name, Zantac. And this was first made in the mid-70s, and it came on the market in 1981, as I say, as a treatment for those particular ailments. And very effective it seems to have been in doing that. So in 2018, for example, it lay just outside the top 40 drugs that are being prescribed in the US, and with about 18 million prescriptions in that year. So, you know, it's a popular drug. Now, problems with it. So in 2019, people were analysing this drug and they found the presence of a thing called N-nitrosodimethylamine. Now, I know.
Just some word I don't know anything about.
So N-nitrosodimethylamine is a carcinogen, meaning that it causes cancer. So you obviously don't want any of this in any drugs that you are taking. And so this was found out, essentially, or it certainly was reinforced by a paper that was published in 2016 in the journal Carcinogenesis, Jace. And that was titled, Oral Intake of Ranitidine Increases Urinary Excretion of N-nitrosodimethylamine, blah, blah, blah. So basically, what they did was that they fed some volunteers some ranitidine, and then they analyzed the urine, and they found decent amounts of this carcinogen in their urine. And so this was sort of a red flag saying, gosh, you know, this drug, this is containing this carcinogen, this isn't good. And as a result of this, then in 2020, they stopped ranitidine. So it was taken off the market in the USA and the EU and in Australia. As a result of this, and there's also a class action lawsuit, of course there is, in the States, where they are saying that this has caused cancer in over 100,000 plaintiffs.
Wow.
Yeah, well, you know, it's the States.
It's a class action.
It's a litigious country, you know. So that may or may well not be the case. But the thing is that it's been taken off the market because of these concerns about the presence of this carcinogen in it. Now, surprise, surprise, the paper that said that they were finding high levels of this carcinogen in the ranitidine has been retracted last week. I know.
What?
Yes, indeed. So the authors are now saying that they made a mistake, and that's difficult for scientists to admit sometimes. So what they did... They were analysing the urine of these patients using a thing called gas chromatography mass spectrometry. Okay?
Lots of big words.
I know. Hope you're loving it out there, Auckland. and what they need to do in that is they need to heat the sample up to a relatively high temperature, around about 250 degrees. Okay? Now, what they've subsequently found is that ranitidine by itself is thermally unstable. And if you heat it up to these relatively warm temperatures, it does in fact decompose, and it does give you this N-nitrosodimethylamine, okay? But only at these very high temperatures, okay? So they now have realized this. They realize the method that they're using was not really applicable, and are the results now valid? That's the big question. So
is there any way to test it?
Well, they're going to have to use another method. Okay, so there is another method called liquid chromatography mass spectrometry, and where you can just do this analysis now sort of at room temperature. And from what I understand, apparently they have done this in the past and they've found very, very low amounts of this carcinogen in there. The question then becomes, are those low amounts dangerous at all? And so this, you know, this retraction puts the whole thing into question now. And I can imagine, number one, the drug companies who are making this stuff will be very upset about all of this. And they will be claiming that this lawsuit gets thrown out because, you know, hasn't got anything to stand on, et cetera, et cetera. I guess the moral of the story is you've got to be really, really careful when you're doing these sorts of analyses. So, you know, scientists are sadly fallible, but at least they fess up when they are.
Yeah. Well, lastly, we're looking at some other dangerous stuff to humans looking at lead in petrol and how that's sort of impacting, well, in this case, London.
Yeah, incredible. So those of you who are old enough to remember, probably neither of you two, when they took lead out of petrol in New Zealand, which was 1996.
Wasn't alive.
Yeah, there we go. Thought not. I was going to say, well, you will remember there was a whole lot of trouble seals and gaskets and stuff like that when they took the lead out of the petrol in New Zealand. And there was sort of these spontaneous car fires and stuff like that, blah, 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 blah. But it's all fine now. So we don't need the lead in the petrol. Now, some people in the UK have done some studies of residual lead in the atmosphere in London. And in the UK, lead was taken out of petrol in 1999, so it's been out for a good 20-odd years or so. And the remarkable finding is that they are still finding lead that is sourced from petrol in the air in London 20-odd years later, which is quite remarkable. So they reckon 32 to 43% of the lead in the air currently in London still comes from petrol, which is quite astonishing. Yeah. I know. Now, the actual amounts in the air are small. Okay, so apparently the highest concentration of lead in London air was in the mid-80s, and the current levels now are around about 2% of those. But again, of that 2%, around about a third, almost to a half, is sourced from petrol, the lead that was in petrol, which is, you know, quite astonishing. So it's still there, and it still may well be having an impact on people's health. Apparently, the levels that are in the air are around about 100 times the natural levels of lead. Remember, lead is perfectly natural. Lead occurs in nature. We just dig it up out of the ground, and, you know, the safest place to put it is probably back in the ground where, you know, whence it came. But it's bad for brain development. It's bad for infants. So, you know, any sort of exposure to lead and stuff like that. And remember, we used to have lead in paint. You know, so no, you don't remember because you're too young.
But I did know about that.
You know, yeah. But an interesting side note to all of this is the guy who first put lead in petrol. His name was Thomas Midgley Jr. And not only did he put lead in petrol, but he also invented chlorofluorocarbons, which
I think this guy wanted to destroy our atmosphere. I really do, because
and I think I read somewhere a quote, something like that Midgley was the worst organism that's ever been let loose on the atmosphere, something like that, or the most dangerous organism in the atmosphere.
I would have to agree.
And amazingly, he got given the American Chemical Society's highest honour, the Priestley Medal, in 1941 for his work on chlorofluorocarbons, because these revolutionised refrigeration.
Yeah.
So up until then, refrigeration was difficult, but now they had these gases that could do this sort of stuff, you know, and this was a big, big advance. And it wasn't until probably 30-odd years later they then figured out that these chlorofluorocarbons were busy eating up the ozone, and that's how we end up with our ozone hole. So, you know, we're older and wiser. The whole lead thing was to stop motors knocking, so pre-ignition or something like that when they got hot. So the lead would stop that, and you know, everyone knows that lead's bad for you, but it wasn't until the mid-90s that it got phased out even here in New Zealand. So hindsight is a wonderful thing. But
one step at a time.
But boy, oh boy, that poor guy's legacy. I mean,
yeah.
unlike those two Nobel laureates that we mentioned at the start of this, his is somewhat tarnished, shall
we
say.
It was one of the few things I do remember from chemistry class at high school. So, yeah.
Very good.
Sweet. Well, that was Dear Science with Alan Blackman.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.